Well, yeah, my name's Rita. This is the last session of the Marxism Conference before the All-In this evening. It's on the Workers' Party of Brazil, From Radical Hopes to Embracing Neoliberalism. Mick Armstrong is the speaker. He'll introduce the topic. There'll be time for discussion, as per usual. And then at the end, we've got some announcements. But, yeah, without further ado, Mick.
Bolsonaro government, so the election of somebody who's pretty much close to being an open fascist as president of Brazil obviously sent shockwaves around the world. And most left commentators on those developments concentrated, on the dangers and the threats posed by this new government to the working class movement in Brazil and the question about the need to fight him. And they're important questions and understandable. Most people are focused on that. But I think we have to, understanding the developments and how this occurred, we have to go beyond that and to ask deeper questions. How could this disaster for the working class happen in Brazil? What went wrong on our side? And what are the lessons that socialists should draw for future struggles? And to come to grips with all those questions, I think we have to conduct a serious analysis and study of the history and development of the Workers' Party, the PT. That was the main party of government in Brazil for 16 of the last 20 years. And not just the PT itself and its role in government, but its intersection with the broader working class movement and class struggle. Now, what I want to do in this talk is first look at the origins of the PT. How was it formed? Out of the massive struggles, the massive working class struggles that swept Brazil in the 70s and 1980s, in the period under the military dictatorship. To look at the nature of the political forces that cohered in the early years of the party and shaped it, and the role played then in its move to the right by its charismatic leader, Lula, Luiz Inácio da Silva, who went on in 2002 to win the presidential elections, and how that in turn, that his presidency prepared the ground for the current right-wing resurgence. And finally, I will spend a fair bit of time looking at the role of the revolutionary left forces inside the PT, who were an important factor in the party itself, and why were they unable to build mass opposition to the PT's abject capitulation to neoliberalism. Okay. So, the origins. Well, after years of heavy repression under the military dictatorship, which lasted from 1964 to 1985, the workers' movement exploded into action in 1978. And this explosion ushered in well over a decade of massive class battles and mass strikes. Year after year, wave after wave of strikes swept out of the car factories and the engineering plants centered around Sao Paulo and its suburbs and spread right across Brazil through all the major industrial centers. And meanwhile, in the north of the country, the battle on the land heated up, both for land rights and the great struggles in the sugar plantation, and that involved the north. Brazil had gone through a massive period of industrial expansion during the 1960s and 70s. That saw the development of huge manufacturing plants, car plants, engineering workers, plants, chemical factories, and so on. And these cities grew very rapidly. By 1986, Sao Paulo, the key manufacturing centre, had 15 million inhabitants, and Rio, 10 million. And a new working class was born in these decades. The employed labour force grew from 17 million in 1950 to nearly 50 million by 1980. And by 1982, there were 8 million manufacturing workers. And Sao Paulo and its key suburbs, Sao Bernardo, were the main centres of this new manufacturing workforce, with huge factories like the Volkswagen plant employing up to 30,000 workers. And it was in São Paulo and São Bernardo that key groups of working class militants cohered to form the PT and the CUT, the Trade Union Confederation, that was associated with the party. This working class left emerged was influenced by a variety of political currents, in particular by Catholic liberation theology, and involved groups such as the Catholic Workers' Youth. But also a series of socialist militants developed who were critical of the Stalinist and reformist politics of the Brazilian Communist Party and its Maoist offshoots. As early as 1968, embryonic factory committees started to emerge, set up by rank-and-file workers in a number of workplaces. But the military crushed this incipient working-class movement, sending in thousands of troops with machine guns and tanks to smash a major factory occupation at the time. And in the wake of that, that very severe defeat, there was not another real mass strike for another decade in Brazil. Hundreds of workers were arrested, tortured and imprisoned, and you know, there was a real sense of demoralisation and defeat. But defeat can have lead to two reactions. On the one hand, there are those who now give up and abandon the class struggle and look for easier political options, and those who are determined, well, that next time we will do things better. The openly reformist sections of the workers' movement, such as those associated with the Communist Party and its Maoist breakaway, now began to embed themselves in the legally tolerated opposition, the military allowed, both two forms of it, an official corrupt union bureaucracy, which was legally allowed by the officials, and a bourgeois party, the Brazilian Democratic Movement, which was sort of the officially allowed military sanctioned opposition. And that. So a whole section of the left now embedded themselves in that. Another section of the left went into armed guerrilla struggles, and then on the other hand, the people I want to talk about here, a whole section of militant rank-and-file workers now concentrated in São Paulo, concentrated in underground work inside their workplaces, agitating for the formation of factory committees. And they eventually cohered as the metal workers' opposition, organising against the corrupt union bureaucracy associated with the military regime. And then, in 1978, the storm burst. After long years of dangerous, dedicated, and patient work by the metal workers' opposition, they now started to achieve significant results. They had established strong factory groups in a whole series of the main factories in São Paulo, and their illegal newspaper circulated in all the major engineering works. That was the São Paulo metalworkers' opposition. In São Bernardo, the suburb of São Paulo, the political developments were different. And this is where Lula emerged from. And he became, you know, one of the key leaders in the PT. And the differences between São Paulo and São Bernardo are very important in terms of the workers' movement in both places in the subsequent development and understanding of the politics of the PT. Lula was not a rank-and-file working-class militant in the same way. He became a leading light in the official military-sanctioned union as a protege of a union bureaucrat, Paulo Vidal. Now, Vidal was not as corrupt as most of the union bureaucrats of the time, but nonetheless, he operated within the framework of the legal setup sanctioned by the military, and that brought him into conflict with many of the militants. Contrast to that, you know, the metal workers' opposition were doing this, you know, long-going, rank-and-file work underground, whereas Lula was only on the shop floor as a worker for 3 years before he became a union official in 1969. By 1975, he'd been elected on Vidal's ticket as the president of the union, and then in 1977, he broke with Vidal, and after that, the São Bernardo Union, which he was now the head of, became became more combative. Okay. Well, the storm burst with a strike by 3,200 workers at the Scania plant in San Bernardo. And a mass strike broke out there, and it spread very rapidly to the Ford factories, to Perkins Engineering, Mercedes, and that. And by the second week of this illegal strike, 78,000 workers were out on strike. In every factory, workers adopted the exact same tactic. They turned up to work, clocked in, went to their machines, and then refused to stop. They just stood there. This tactic was immensely successful. They won a major pay rise. The dam had burst. The engineering militants who had taken the lead now had created the situation for the mass of the industrial working class to pour through. Within 2 months of the Scania strike, 250,000 workers were on strike, and then it started to spread from the engineering industry and outside Sao Paulo and its suburbs and that. The strike organisation in Sao Paulo was massively stronger at a rank and file level than in Sao Bernardo. The metal workers' opposition in Sao Paulo organised meeting after meeting, factory by factory. 150,000 strike bulletins were produced and distributed in all the large firms. And factory committees started to be established throughout the engineering industry and now spreading to other industries. And on the back of these strikes, the steps started to be taken in 1969 to form the PT. 69 was the year that the military regime started to loosen up and allow for the formation of political parties. Okay. Now, the Sao Paulo, the Sao Bernardo union leagues around Lulu, you know, was some of the key element, not the only element by far, and that, but key element in the formation of the PT. And they saw politics as distinct from workers' struggle. And this separation of workers' struggle, economic struggle, from politics is a traditional part of classical social democracy. From the union, the Sao Bernardo union leaders saw it. Well, the union was there to look after and organise around workers' day-to-day industrial grievances, their pay rises and so on. But when it came to politics, that should be left by Labour politicians in Parliament. Now, the workers' opposition militants rejected this approach and organised hard against it. They had a genuine bottom-up approach, which emphasised working-class self-activity and not relying on either union officials or parliamentarians. Unfortunately, though, their framework was still limited. They did not draw the conclusion that it was necessary to organise politically as revolutionaries in the factories. The factory committees they established essentially remained sectional, very militant, but focused primarily on organising around industrial grievances. The movement that coalesced now, that formed the PT, included the people around the officials and so on in Sao Bernardo, but also included a series of other elements. Radical Catholics, leftist politicians from the Brazilian democratic movement started to desert it and join the new party, and a whole layer of new militant trade unionists, plus a whole number of socialists from Trotskyists, Maoists, plus former guerrillas now joined the new party. And that. And those revolutionaries in the early years of the PT were able to organise pretty openly in the party. Now, the formation of the PT was undoubtedly a major step forward for the working class of Brazil. It was an explicitly working class party, which consciously broke from the populism of the Brazilian bourgeois democratic movement and the class, it totally rejected, at least at a formal level in early years, the class struggle, popular frontist approach of the Communist Party and Stalinist reformism. And unsurprisingly then, in its early years, the PT came under strident attack from the Communist Party. They condemned it for opposing a class alliance with the middle class and with supposed progressive sections of the bourgeoisie. So there was a big debate about that for a number of years. And the key differences between the approach of the Communist Party and the early PT were, one, the the PT had a genuine working class base and an orientation to the key sections of the industrial working class. Secondly, that the PT was an open, democratic party committed to control from its rank and file members. And thirdly, it had an orientation to democratic trade unionism, all of which the Communist Party classically rejected. The main limitation of the early PT was it did not put forward a clear and distinctive program for what it was trying to achieve. The founding manifesto made no reference to, their attitude to overthrowing capitalism, didn't put forward an explicit revolutionary program or anything. And the layer of union leaders in say, a Barnardo that played a key role in forming the new trade union federation, the CUT, pretty much wanted the party, to be one that will take, go into parliament, take legislative action, which will open up space for the unions to operate, unfettered by legal restrictions, without confronting the state. In 1982, more right-wing sections of the left argued that it was the PT was still too weak, and it was premature to campaign for it, and said the left should orient to the lesser evil, the bourgeois Brazilian democratic movement. Just as, reformists in the US today argue to support democratic party politicians rather than attempting to build a new working class party. They were defeated at the time, fortunately, in Brazil by a coalition of genuinely left-wing forces that included the Trotskyists and Catholic Church elements. 1984 was the golden year for the PT left. The party grew enormously, won 10% of the vote in the elections in 1985, and by 1987, the PT had, on paper, about 500,000 members, about roughly maybe 50,000 of whom were activists. Now, the very high level of class struggle in the 70s and 1980s limited the space for the leadership of the Trade Union Federation, the CUT, or of the PT itself to move to the right. You get a feel for what was going on. In December 1986, 15 million workers struck in the largest strike in history up until that point in time. And that was typical of this period. However, by the end of the 80s, the leadership of the PT was becoming more incorporated into Brazilian capitalism and gradually became less democratic in operation, and the leadership tried to move against some of the left groups in the party. And sections of the leadership now tried to move to shift to appeal to more middle-class elements in society. At this stage, the Trade Union Federation was still to the left of the PT leadership. It, in a general sense, represented the working-class militants in the PT. And as I said, it was the left of the main PT leadership. However, it too, the CUT leadership, did not have clear revolutionary politics. They were classical centrists. On one hand, oscillating between revolutionary rhetoric at times to a day-to-day left reformist practice. They focused on electoralist interventions and constitutional change. This led to a major clash in 1986 between the leadership of the CUT and the metal workers' opposition militants, who pushed for an openly socialist and revolutionary program and challenged the CUT and PT leadership. And the metalworkers' opposition, in alliance with other oppositionists and other unions, formed the CUT from below, challenged the PT CUT leadership, and won 28.6% of the vote in the CUT elections. In 1989, Lula ran as the presidential candidate for the PT. And in the runoff elections that occurred, he did exceedingly well, winning 47% of the vote. However, 5 years later in the 1994 elections, Lula was trounced. And Lula and his supporters now draw the conclusion, something that they've been moving towards really since the late 80s, that they had to move the party substantially to the right. And this was reinforced by the generalised shift in these years with the ascendancy of neoliberalism in internationally and so on, which gradually flowed through into Brazil, and by the demoralization of sections to the left, the Stalinist sections to the left, of course, by the collapse of the Berlin Wall and Stalinism in Russia. On paper, the left of the PT was still strong, well into the 90s. So, for example, at the 1993 Congress of the Party, the left won a majority in the elections. And the party adopted a program for revolutionary struggle. But in a sense, this was misleading. Lula, who had massive personal influence, was exerting this and was winning for himself greater autonomy in terms of how he was to campaign in the presidential elections of 1994. And under his influence, the PT's election campaign moderated its rhetoric, sought relationships with business groups, and began to make alliances with various bourgeois parties, including quite conservative ones. And by 2002, when Lula won the presidential elections, this retreat, this right-wing retreat, had gone a very long way. In 2002, Lula chose as his vice presidential candidate a billionaire, José Alencar, and the PT dropped the word socialism from their platform and adopted the slogan of Lula, peace and love. As president, though, Lula was the head of the largest party in the Congress, but it was not a majority in the Congress. So he formed alliances with various middle-of-the-road and with some rightist parties. And in order to cement this political coalition, he began to buy the representatives of these other parties, paying them monthly allowances. Bribes, I think, is the scientific term. Lula and the PT leadership became increasingly autonomous from the membership of the party and more loosely connected to their social base in the working class. And though the party had been created by the union, it was never a Labor Party in the sense we talk about it in Australia or Britain, because the unions never were affiliated to the party as such. But even though that didn't happen, now Lula is increasingly imposing the domination of the party bureaucracy over the unions, subordinating the CUT to the PT itself. The CUT and the Metal Workers Union became essentially captives of the PT, and many of their leaders went on to become part of the PT's leadership and staffers of the party. Now, under Lula, a whole series of union leaders were appointed to position to be workers' representatives, well, supposedly workers' representatives, on pension funds and so on. And by dint of these positions, they became major players in Brazilian finance. And that meant, you know, as the head of these, you know, superannuation funds, you know, they were pressing for redundancies, cutbacks, sell-offs, and so on, in search of higher returns on their investments. Lula developed a social liberal strategy. On one hand, neoliberal policies to advance the profits of big business interests in the country. On the other hand, and those policies very much undermine the living standards of the key sections of the working class, which were the historic base of the PT in the southern cities of Brazil. At the same time, he combined that with a series of welfare measures aimed at the poorer population in the northern parts of Brazil, and that who traditionally never voted for the PT, it always voted for the Conservative Party. So the historical base of the PT electorate starts to shift now away from the core militants in the metal factories and so on of the south. For a while, with the economy holding up, a major export boom and minerals and so on, you know, in some ways similar to Australia, especially exports to China, the PT could keep winning elections and contain popular discontent. But after 2010, the economy slowed quite sharply, and disillusionment with the PT government accelerated rapidly. And because no coherent fighting left opposition had been built to Lula, either inside or outside the PT, this virtually guaranteed that the main beneficiaries of the growing discontent in society as living standards came under sharp attack would be the right and eventually Bolsonaro. Okay, to turn to the question of the far left in the party. Why was it then that the far left, that had been historically strong in the PT, was unable to build mass opposition to the shift to the right, this turn of Lula and co to neoliberalism? As I mentioned earlier, there was a variety of currents, of left currents inside the PT from its earliest days. Some of them were on the right wing of the party. A lot of the former guerrillas went from armed guerrilla struggle to becoming right-wing reformists pretty early on. They were heavily electoralist and sought to moderate the PT's approach. And by the 90s, a lot of the former guerrillas had gone over openly to social liberal policies. But others, and the majority of the left, took a more clearly left-wing stance. In the 1990s, there were about a dozen or more groups in the PT that saw themselves as revolutionary, both Trotskyist and Maoist currents. And most of them argued for, you know, fighting to turn the PT into a genuine revolutionary party. By 1986, these various revolutionary groups had something like 5,000 active members, which is about 10% of the active membership of the PT. One of the main revolutionary groups inside the PT was the Trotskyist current associated with the Fourth International, that cohered under the name of Socialist Democracy, DS. By the end of the 1980s, Socialist Democracy, DS, had about 1,000 members, but they had the support of a much broader layer of the PT membership. And generally, the DS could get about 10% of the delegates to the PT's national meetings. The DS played a particularly important role two of the key southern states where the PT had a strong base. Excuse my Portuguese, but in Minas Gerais and Rio Grande do Sul. After Sao Paulo, these two southern states were in the early years the PT's most important bases for a long year time. Now, the DS's perspective was to fight for the leadership of the PT, as they believed there was a serious possibility that it could be transformed into a revolutionary party. They sought to combine building the PT as an independent workers' party and building the DS as a revolutionary current within the PT. The DS characterised the PT as a party whose future was open, whose orientation, which had been in dispute since its foundation, had not been settled, and that the outcome was not predetermined. They argued that the PT could evolve into a revolutionary party, but only if a series of decisive political battles were won against the more reformist forces. Now, we could argue whether this analysis perspective was correct even in the early years, but at least it was, you know, seemingly, you know, fitted with the situation in those years. But as years went on, quite clearly this analysis proved overly optimistic. Now, the real problem was that the DS held on to this analysis that they could turn the PT into a revolutionary party for way too long. Indeed, in some sense, over the period, it got worse. By 1998, at their conference, the DS adopted a characterisation of the PT as a revolutionary party in construction. Now, this was a very dangerous formulation. It risked disarming and confusing DS's own members in relationship to the serious problems which were already emerging inside the PT. And many DS members now got used to thinking that there would never be any conflict between their two identities. The identity, on the one hand, as a member of the PT, on the other hand, as revolutionary socialists and a member of a revolutionary socialist current within the PT. The characterisation of the PT as a revolutionary party in construction minimise the qualitative changes necessary to achieve turning a party which, you know, defended basic working-class rights and the immediate interests of the working class into a party that was going to fight for socialism and actually fight for the overthrow of capitalism in a revolution. Such an approach demanded a very clear understanding of the limits of bourgeois institutions, such as the state and parliament, and the limits of the struggle within them. And this obviously was never shared by the PT as a whole. For many years, the DS was an alliance with Lula's tendency, the articulation, which supposedly gave the left a majority in the PT leadership. But in reality, this was pretty delusional in terms of the real process that was going on under Lula's influence. One DS leader subsequently wrote, "Lula wanted to base the party on a broad, multi-class coalition, and he was in favour of more conservative programs. He was very shrewd, would have others present his ideas, and when he lost, it did not hurt him. We on the left were often able to defeat him up until the early 2000s. But these seeming victories of the left were built on sand. The DS, like much of the rest of the far left inside the PT, downplayed the PT's weaknesses and had illusions in the PT leadership and their ability to hold it to account and pull it to the left. And in practice, they downplayed the need for revolutionaries to maintain their independence from the PT and from the leadership of the CUT, the Trade Union Federation, and to build their own independent forces. Many DS members by the 90s could not really imagine a political existence outside the PT. And they held to the position that the PT could be turned into a revolutionary party for way too long. The DS itself began to establish a parliamentary group in the state of Rio Grande do Sul and its capital, Porto Alegre, where the PT left was particularly strong and where the DS was very strong. They began to be integrated into the structures of the bourgeois state. And from about 1988 onwards, the PT itself became more integrated into the structures of the state at the local government level and various state governments. And then, of course, subsequently, after 2002 and the victory in the presidential elections, into the federal government. The party becomes more bureaucratized and internal democracy in the party starts to be eroded. The election of Lula as president in 2002 brought the crisis of the left in the PT to a head. In broader society, and in the broader working class, there was immense enthusiasm for the Lula's election. And given that, and the whole problematic relationship between the PT and the DS was very ill prepared to stand up to the enormous pressures they were now under for participation in Lula's neoliberal government. One prominent DS figure, Heloisa Helena, took a principled left-wing stand. However, the DS majority collapsed in the face of these reformist pressures and voted to take part in Lula's government. The Rubicon had been crossed, and the DS now, I have to say, was no longer in any meaningful sense a revolutionary. One leading DS member, Miguel Roseto, became the Minister for Agricultural Development, for Rural Development. And even when Heloisa Helena and other left MPs were expelled from the PT in December 2003, and it was clear now that the PT was becoming a Blairite neoliberal party, a third way party, the DS as a whole did not break from the PT. Heloisa and her supporters went on to play a prominent role formation of a new left-wing party, PSOL, the Party of Socialism and Liberty. It was not until 2 years after the formation of the PT government that the left-wing minority inside DS eventually split from the reformist majority and left the PT. Of the 2,000 members of DS, which they had at the end of 2003, only a little over 500 were to break from the left from the PT. But even that disguises how bad the outcome was, because almost half of those who broke did not remain politically organised after leaving the PT, and either never joined PSOL or left it soon afterwards. In Rio Grande do Sul, the state that had almost half the DS membership, and where the members were most involved in local government bodies and in the structure of the PT and in the trade unions, parliamentary offices, and so on, 90% of DS members remained in the PT. Okay. Why then did the bulk of the DS members, who were supposedly revolutionary socialists, not break? Now, undoubtedly part of the explanation was the general state of the class struggle in Brazil and internationally. The impact of the neoliberal offensive, the decline in the level of strikes, the shift to the right, and so on. Another key factor was that DS had hundreds of members working full-time for the PT, for the CUT, or for the local and regional governments, or other organisations linked to the PT. And this was particularly true in Rio Grande do Sul. For many DS members, a break from the PT was very difficult to imagine. Others simply weren't prepared to face the difficulties of starting all over again, trying to rebuild a socialist organisation from the start in much reduced material circumstances. Leave aside the reduced material circumstances of their own personal lives if they were to resign from their perks. Overall, there was an excessive identification with the PT and an underestimation of the conflicts to come and the scale of the reformist pressures. This underestimation continued throughout the second half of the 1990s, when the PT slowly lost the more radical characteristics of its early years. The DS as a whole was also far from clear about the very serious political implications of taking part in governments within the framework of a bourgeois state. Furthermore, the formulation that they had used for a long time, that the PT was a revolutionary party in construction, paid insufficient attention to the problems of the PT's evolution and tended to make DS members forget that there was a difference between their two identities as revolutionary socialists on the one hand and PT members on the other, and that these two identities were bound to come into sharp and serious conflict. In fact, contrary to many DS members' assumptions, there was no straightforward and permanent compatibility between the two identities. And when the two did come into sharp conflict, the formation of the Lula government in 2002 and the hard neoliberal course of the PT identity had in its favour a social and material force that could only be encountered by a much stronger revolutionary identity and ideological coherence. And that, unfortunately, had not been established over the previous two decades, anywhere near to the extent it needed to be. Okay, to conclude. To go back to the start, the formation of the PT on the back of the enormous working class struggles of the late 70s and through the 80s undoubtedly was a major advance for the working class of Brazil. It opened the road towards independent working class politics. However, of course, nothing is guaranteed in politics. The capital system, state apparatus, its myriad of institutions and so on has an enormous capacity to absorb and co-opt even the most insurgent working class forces. Indeed, it has the capacity to turn something which is a creation of the working class itself, seemingly a creation to challenge the system, into its reverse. You know, something that goes from galvanizing workers to fight to overthrow capitalism on one hand, becomes instead the instrument for their subordination to the system and their continued exploitation of the system. We see that time and time again, the trade union movement. And this is precisely what happened with the PT. It was transformed from being a radical working class party into an instrument of neoliberal austerity. Now, it is not slightly surprising that the leading PT members of parliament and their allies and the trade unions party bureaucracy should play this role. I mean, that's been played out time and time again over the last 100 years in the social democratic parties and in the trade unions. That has actually been the standard pattern of working class history. The tragedy in Brazil was that the left of the PT that proclaimed its commitment to revolutionary Marxism and had a significant weight in the party did not measure up to the task of leading working class opposition to the degeneration of the PT. because of its lack of revolutionary clarity and a false strategic analysis, rather than being part of the solution, the PT left also became part of the problem and contributed to the defeat of the working class movement. The PT left abandoned its revolutionary principle and crossed over to the side of the class enemy. It is a pretty sorry lesson, but nonetheless an important one for revolutionaries to learn if we go into the battles of the future. We're seeing today a revival on the left internationally of the left reformist ideas associated with Kautsky and Polanski about using parliament and the state to supposedly advance towards socialism. And also ideas that there is no sharp divide between reformist and revolutionary politics. Well, I think the experience of the PT in Brazil sharply underscores the need for revolutionaries to make absolutely no concessions to any of these ideas, either on the organisational or political level. They only lead to catastrophic defeats, and we'll see worse ones than in Brazil. Now, of course, it's far from guaranteed that if the left in Brazil had, in the PT, had held fast to its principles and fought a relentless fight against the party bureaucracy and the party leadership around Lula, that they would have triumphed in the end. But what is undoubtedly the case, that if the left in the PT had waged such a fight, then the working class of Brazil today would be in a much better position to be politically cohered and repulse the onslaught which they are going to face from the Bolsonaro government. Thank you.